Good day to all. Anyone who enjoyed the sheep shearing one, they should listen to this one too, because the start of the sheep shearing is in this one. And the challenge of actually getting a job with these hardcore bastards. We're rolling, Pommy. We're rolling. Pick up that sheep shit.
For 1,500 kilometres, the bush raced past my window. Max and Penny alternated the driving, 140 k's an hour, dropping speed for the wedge-tail eagles that were feeding on the roadkill. The dogs, Max and Penny's dogs, were dingo cross and covered in ticks, like big cattle ticks. I tried to dig out their heads with my nails after the blood sacs burst in my fingers. The dogs farted and the dials on the speedometer wound round and round. It was too risky to drive through the night for us, and for the big reds, the kangaroos that bounced across the asphalt. Sometimes you'd see like a full herd of cows that had been wiped out by a road train. It was bloody really sad, but comical at the same time, because they'd all be like bloated up in rigor mortis at the side of the road, and the like, the legs sticking up in the air like they were just toys that had been thrown across the ground. Looked crazy. And the wedge-tail eagles, they're massive. The only way, I think it's, they don't weigh much. I can't remember. It's either 3 or 9 kilos. I think it's 3 kilos. But they can take on a roo. Like, they're really efficient hunters. And they, basically their thumb claw is pretty barbaric, but efficient. They'll wait till they're chasing something like a roo, and they'll fly up behind it and just slice this thumb claw up into their skull and through the brain and kill them outright. Gnarly. But like a lot of animals, they've adapted to a bit of scavenging too, and a lot of them would get killed by road trains and cars and other vehicles when they're feeding on roadkill. Max and Penny rolled out their swags. The thick mattress held back the fawns from the scrub. A mosquito net in the hood kept them safe from scorpions, snakes, spiders, and other blood-robbing bludgers. I'd left Brad with a tent, so it's just me and this cheap shit polyester sleeping bag. I woke encircled by red kangaroos, soaked in dew, and the red desert stuck to it. 20 hours after Max and Penny had stopped to give me a lift, we reached Carnarvon on the west coast of Australia. It was our 1,500 kilometre lift. That's bonkers. My neighbour, young lad, he's just come back from driving to Western Australia from East Coast Australia. Been up the coast there, done lots of boating, and in a little like oversized tinny. Nearly got swept out to sea. Well, it did get swept out 50 k's to in the ocean due to the big tides. Nearly ended up in the Tiwi Islands. Ended up having to get saved. But they said he spent $14,000 on fuel. He's only gone like 2.5 months. 14 grand. Holy shit. But fuel's gone up skyrocket. It's 3 times what it was when I first came here. It's $1 a litre. Now, he said he was paying up to $3 a litre out in the middle of nowhere, like Alice Springs. Crazy. Maybe everyone will ride bicycles around when they go travelling now, and my stories will mean nothing. Self-propelled will be the new Leadfoot. Carnarvon. Funny story about Carnarvon too. Coffs Harbour, where we're from, it's famous for having a big banana. and it's got some slight undertones, connotations there, obviously. But Carnarvon have got a banana too, but it's not as big as Coffs Harbour banana. Dumb shit. I eyed down the long furrows that I'd made in the earth. The hoe fell to the ground. I hung from a tree branch. My vertebra pulled apart and clunked. Ed, an early 20s English bloke, lay spread eagle in the dirt. He had wrapped his shirt around his head to protect him from the sun, and he had a goatee hanging off the end of his chin. The handles of the hose were short, and after 9 hours of stooping in the same position, our backs were shagged. We had agreed a piece rate of $3 per row with a farmer. But when we asked for our money, he claimed that a row was both sides of the cucumbers, not one. He scratched a line for each one on the flap of a cucumber box. Okay, 30 row, $3 divided by 2, $45 each. The farmer's brothers, sensing trouble, stood close by, holding their hoes like weapons. We were angry. Well, I was. Feeling the pain of an honest day's work and about to be ripped off. But if we lost our cool, those short-handled hoes that had done us so much damage would possibly do some more and would be thrown off the plantation with nothing. So we waited. The illegal workers and the con men. This wasn't me working, this was my doppo, because he didn't have a work visa, so he wouldn't be not working. They looked at us, we looked at them. It seemed hopeless. Finally, the biggest and most confident brother spoke Vietnamese and laughed, and his brothers reluctantly reached for his wallet and paid us the right money. We hobbled back to the hostel with an unspoken understanding that we wouldn't be coming back. The plantation owners of Carnarvon relied on desperately poor travellers to work for them. They were the easiest to exploit. No Aussies would do this shit work. I kept like about $1,000 in my account, and that was like my buffer, so that when I got in these situations or if I needed an emergency flight back to England, I could just like do it and I wouldn't have to bloody do like a lot of these travellers, a lot of the other travellers. They weren't as smart. They spent themselves right down to the bone, and then they had to do most desperate work to survive. And this Tom guy, he was actually shoplifting on a daily basis to make up for not having enough money. And his dad was a copper back in England. He was a real proper guy too. And, educated type, but desperate times and all that. He became just a thief. So Tom was also actually going to be a policeman when he went back to England. Meantime, he stole food from the local supermarket to survive. He'd proudly empty out his jacket onto the hostel table like it was a catch of fish. 5 days later, Bri walked into the hostel. His young-looking mush lit up the place. The hostel was a morgue. Many travellers who had arrived expecting to make a fortune were pissed off and moaned a lot. The lazy bludgeon ones cleaned out the communal shelf and sniffed around the kitchen looking at people's food. But Bri had found a campsite, pitched a tent and already got a job picking tomatoes. I grabbed my bags and we left. It was good, just walking with Bri again, travelling with Bri again, just moving across the planet with a good mate by my side. Next day, Ed and me got work at Rick's plantation. Ed? I thought that guy was called Tom. But sorry, I mixed up the guy's name. The guy who was a shoplifter was apparently called Ed, not Tom. Who gives a shit? Right. Did anyone pick that up? Yeah, pay attention. Ed and me got work at Rick's plantation weeding banana trees. It was hourly paid, so we could work a little slower, and the hoe handles were longer. We sat down in the earth for an unofficial 5, hiding from the sun, in amongst the thick, waxy banana leaves. I kept my hoe close by, And sure enough, Rick came burning up the drive in his Land Cruiser, hoping to catch us out. I wiggled my hoe a bit, making like I was working, but Ed couldn't get to his feet in time. And that was the end of Ed. Rick said he needed a reliable worker for the season. I fit the description. I was still finding it hard to lie. My doppelganger came clean about the work visa. He told me I'd have to leave too. The work was so lousy it was impossible to feel slightly depressed about losing my job. I wandered back along the road to the campsite, pleased to have the rest of the day to myself. Over the steaming pans of pasta and rice and the chaos of hungry fruit pickers preparing dinner, I'd become acquainted with a fellow Yorkshireman called Tim. As I sauntered back to the campsite after getting the boot from Rick, he pulled up in his Holden. "Hey, Rich, do you want to come on a trip to Coral Bay?" Bri arrived back from work. It was already dark. He was worn out after 5 days on the road trying to catch up his old friend, and without any rest, he was busting his ass for $8 an hour. He sat down in the entrance to the tent and took off his festering trainers. His whole body ached. It would have been too easy to fall back into the tent and miss dinner. But while he was stalling on getting up again, he spotted a handwritten note weighed down against the wind with two bananas. Holding the note toward the lights of the campsite kitchen, he could just make out my scruffy writing. "Bri, sorry man, I had to bail. Enjoy the bananas and I'll see you in Perth." Bri was getting a complex by now. Nah, it was just like, fuck it. Like I said, fruit picking, they make a big deal out of it. "Oh yes, you know, we really look after the foreign people coming over here and we allow them to pick our fruit." And half the time, you're just dog working, filling boxes. Even in New Zealand, I'd done it like apples, kiwi fruits. It's just like, whoosh, crack the whip, and if you stop to scratch your ass, you know, you're not making a day's wages. Just bullshit. I think actually the kiwi fruits were probably the best. The apples, you have to fill a box the size of filling your car for $28. I was listening to a guy the other day on YouTube, and he's a current traveller. And if you work 13 weeks in the fruit industry now, you can get an extra year's pay. Extra year's work visa in Australia. So you get 2 years. So apparently there, they've got you right over the barrel, so they just treat you like dogs. Not all of them, but quite a lot of them. So I buggered off with Tim. Tim was a Yorkshireman, and if Flick had wished to prove his point, Tim actually had a whippet with him. Despite a timid face, Tilly was on the run from Tasmania, where Tim had been staying. She had killed a sheep and was about to be shot. Tim had chucked her in the car and made for the mainland. On sunset, we reached Coral Bay. A guy had a boat on dry dock. In exchange for sleep, I watched over his valuables. Tim actually had a girlfriend with him, and I was feeling like a third wheel, so day two, I took off to the sand dunes and kept under the stars. I scratched around in the dunes for fuel and breathed life into the fire. Tilly came rushing into the camp, chasing a nose through the sand. Tim and his girl wasn't far behind. Cheap cask wine washed down fried snags. Hypnotized, we scorched our faces in the coals, matching our stories to the pace of the fire. When the fire died, it was already a memory. Just tracks in the sand around a dying fire. The wind carved through the dunes and out to sea, ripping off the tops of the waves that smashed into the distant reef. I was in my sleeping bag already, in the middle of a moonbeam, guitar across my chest and a few lazy notes. It was warm amongst the aggressive and wild. Above me, just space and stars. I was really part of something amazing. A snake-like rustle in the undergrowth. I drew the opening of my sleeping bag to the size of an eye. While I slept, a redback crawled in to steal my heat. I arrived in Perth in the middle of a very cold night. Goodbye, tropical paradise. Like I said, it was 2,500 km from Broome. I tried not to think about it, but I was woken late the next morning by a whirling noise in the hostel dorm. When I opened my eyes, I could make out hair piling up on the linoleum floor. A hairy, two swing downs from an orangutan guy was shaving his chest with an electric razor. In the middle of the dorm. That was in an asylum. When I looked up at him, he gave me the oddest look from under two big bushy eyebrows. That same night, when I went into the bathroom, the hairy man was there. Stood perfectly still with his arms stuck out like aeroplane wings, staring at himself in the mirror. And this dude was sharing my dorm. Get me out of here! That's the thing about backpacking, like, people think you're roughing it in a tent, but I prefer to be in my own bubble than sharing these spaces with some of these lunatics you don't know who the hell they are. Luckily, Johnny Singh had a room down here in a share house, and he'd offered to let me stay at his place. I got a job as a bricklayer's labourer. I'd have to get up at 5 a.m. and walk 5 kilometres through the cold and darkness to the building site. So I should say that in a Yorkshire accent. You know nothing, you young whippersnappers. You just have to get up at 5 a.m, walk 5 kilometres through cold and darkness to the building site, crack ice off top of water bucket, and drink it. No. But serious, yeah. The boss, he worked me like a dog, humping and cutting bricks, barrowing mud for the brickies. And they'd say, "Yo, mud, mud." They just fucking shout at you. "Excuse me, old bean, would you mind facilitating me with some cement so I can lay one's bricks?" Like, "Yo, mud, mud." He'd promised me 6 months' work, but laid me off after 6 days when his best mate needed a job. He was, you know that thing where you say, "I didn't have a chance to scratch my ass." There was literally, it was like Dave with telling me how to wipe my ass on the boat. It's like literally I'd stopped and I physically scratched my ass when I was wheelbarrowing, and the guy went, "Oi, what are you doing? Get back to work." Fucking asshole, man. I went back to the house. Oh, Johnny Singh must have come back, because it says here Johnny Singh was out painting something. Here we go. I went back to the house. Johnny Singh was out painting something. That's right, he come back. His flatmates, Lance and Kelly, sat watching TV, arguing about absolutely anything. They would. It was the epitome of being... There's a story that if... Or a fact that if you get in a room with a negative person and you leave them there for, like, in a waiting room and you get them chatting, they can send everyone into a negative path. So that's why it's so important to try and stay on the positive path and focus on the light, not on the shadows. But these guys were just sat there, like, they made me feel so happy to be single, put it that way. "Oh, those burgers are good at Hungry. No, they're not, fuck. They're better at Macca's. Ah, fuck. No, that carpet. Oh, it's shit. No, that's good carpet." And they'd have like, these volatile arguments about the most trivial stuff on TV. Like, and the TV blabbed out half-price sale. Burgers, carpets and curtains. Get a car, this, that, blah, 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 blah. Conditions apply. Blah, 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 blah. Conditions apply. My head hurt and my feet itched. I walked into the city. I had to get a job nonetheless. I was in a really timid mood. I didn't seem to have the energy to ask anyone. It wasn't complete despair, but my stomach seemed to knot. I tried to cheer myself up, but it wasn't really working. As I passed the queue for the easy-to-diddle phone, I saw Spooner in the phone booth tapping away. The phone scam required patience and precision. When inserting your phone card, you had to wait a couple of seconds before you hit zero. If you succeeded exactamundo, Your card was spit out untouched, leaving credit on the phone for free. Because back then it was really dear to call back to UK, and I'd normally only do it when I'd had a few beers. My dad would say, please don't ring me drunk next time, Rich. I want to talk a sensible conversation. But it was only when you were drunk, you threw all the money shit to the wind and went, ah, stuff it, I need to talk to my family. Spooner was a mate from Broome, a friendly face on this grey all day. He told me what I wanted to hear. A job would come my way. No point worrying. He was a Brummie too. He's like, let's go and drink. Oh, can I do a Brummie anymore? He's from Birmingham. He said, no point worrying. Let's go and drink a few dog bolters in the pub. We stayed there all afternoon playing cards. If I lost, I had to stay for another beer. If Spooner lost, he'd show me the workings of one of his card tricks. Once is a trick, twice is an education, he told me, if I asked him to repeat a trick. And he would only normally trade a trick for a trick. It was a fair trade. I never saw Spooner again. He was going home as if he was powerless to do anything else. He told me not to write to him. He didn't want to know what was happening on the outside once he was back in Birmingham. I'd heard through the grapevine, Bri was on his way down to meet me in Perth. He'd done his duck with the tomatoes, and he was ready to move on. This was great news if I wasn't already 300 kilometres away on a bus, pulling into a bus station out in the outback. I can't say the name of the place. I'd have to make some up. Lake Juniper. Shedhan required must have experience. Lake Juniper. It was in the Perth Herald. I'd spoken to Tom, the shearing team boss, on the phone. What? Sheep farm? Yep. Experienced? Oh, yeah. Work visa? For sure, mate. For sure. My doppelganger mentioned. As I made my way down the aisle of the bus, I was nervous. And as if some kind of sick joke for the challenge I had set before me, Chariots of Fire was playing on the radio. I think it was about a racer called Seb Kerr, and it was like when he was racing toward the finish line. Da 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 da. And I'm walking down the aisle of this bus going, and I could see this cranky old guy stood outside his old Ford, smoking a derry. Oh, fuck. Little ghost town of a place. If I could blag my way into this job, it would be a miracle. 300 Ks. To get here, if I get turned down, it's going to be a bummer. But desperation leads to desperate acts, and I needed cash. I stepped out into the rain. An old guy in his late 60s stood by his car, struggled off the bonnet and approached me. You Richard? Yeah, that's me. Get in. He pointed to his station wagon. Smoke hung thick in Tom's car, almost as thick as the phlegm that gurgled in the depths of his lungs. He sparked up another fag to put his alveoli to sleep. See that house there? Yeah? That's where I live. Come round at 7, we'll talk. I'll get the missus to cook you a feed. When we reached the shearer's quarters, Tom threaded the key off his keyring and gave it to me. 7 o'clock. He repeated and was gone. The little mustard-coloured fibro cottage was probably a great little house once. Now it wore the scars of the shearers who had bunked here over the years. Most of the doors had large fist or boot-sized dents in them. The chipboard floor was collapsing beneath the carpet. The imprint of an electric fire was branded into the fabric. The bedrooms were dusted over and full of junk. Bits of old shearing tackle, a pair of crusty undies, beer cans, bedheads, old bed bases and heavily stained, foisted mattresses. I knew I could clean it up, though. Take the smelly stuff outside. Clean out the mouse shit that rolled in the drawers when I opened them. That didn't really bother me. What bothered me was the house was deathly silent, and I was completely alone. I sat down on the cleanest-looking mattress and leant back against the wall, watching my breath vaporize in the cold air. The wind was blowing in through a broken window, shaking an orb spider in its web. I started laughing. What a crazy fucking place to end up. I've got a photo of me pulling a right face here too, which is quite funny. But I decided to write a poem, my reflective, slightly depressed moment. It's like, solitary me, mattress, moldy form. Am I really here? House, you creak, you moan. Glass smashed and broken, exposing hungry spider. Kettles leaked its water, just rust and dust inside her. Ship from a mouse, long since dead. A light, the only one, swings above my head. That wouldn't be a bad song, actually. It was going to be tough to talk my way into this job. I knew sort of all about shearing. The only thing I had going for me was Tom was desperate. I'd run through some shearing terms in my head with a Kiwi guy in Perth. Dags. Okay, dag. The shit round a sheep's ass. Wool. Yeah, I know that one. Skin pieces. Yeah, that's when the shearers get a bit gung-ho and the skin comes off with the wool. Oh, right. Wool press. That's how they make the bales of wool. Field. Oh, yeah, I got lamb. Yep. Sorry. Fuck. I took the long way around to Tom's place, skirting the town. I might not get a chance to see it again. There was a pub, a post office, a bank, and a shop. But I didn't see one soul out in the streets. The public swimming pool was closed for winter. And through the locked gates, I could see it was full of leaves, cold and uninviting. When I reached Tom's place, we sat across from each other at the dinner table, shoveling in food as his wife loaded our plates. It's only a small gang that I've got. We don't work weekends. The food was good. Roast lamb and vegetables, apple pie and custard. Better eat fast, just in case he kicks me out. You done this kind of work before? He sensed my pause in answering and gave me a knowing glance. Well, you'll pick it up. I've had loads of people say they're going to come, but no fucker shows up. No, he didn't say that. He wouldn't swear in front of his wife. I've had loads of people saying they're going to come, but no one shows up. I felt good. The food gave me a warm, comfortable feeling, and I had a job. I could have stayed there all night, but I was only Tom's shed hand, by no means his friend. The food was part of the deal, and I'd finished eating, so I got up to leave. Be round here for 6 o'clock, he said, checking out my wrist for a watch. Oh, I pointed to my wrist. It's at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. Long story. I'll knock you up, he decided. Burying my hands deep in pockets of some hand-me-down coat, I wandered merrily back to the quarters, looking up at the starry night. This job could make me enough money to travel for months. I was dreaming of all the places I wanted to see. I was floating, really, I was. At 5:30 the next morning, and still dark, Tom was shouting through the hole in my bedroom window. It'd been so cold during the night there was no need to get dressed. I rolled out of bed onto the floor and grabbed my boots. Tom drove me back round to his place and grunted for me to follow him into the kitchen where Elsie had cooked up a full breakfast. Oh, damn, I said his wife's name. Elsie smiled and told me to dig in. Where are we working today, Tom? Tom lowered his newspaper. Wanting to appear keen, I asked another question, but Tom's curt reply visibly pained him, and with a wobbling cigarette in the side of his mouth, his mumbling was barely coherent. He retreated again behind his wall of words. After breakfast, we drove along the streets of Lake Juniper. I just can't say these guys' names. Waiting outside various houses where Shorty got in the car. The stale green stench of alcohol came with him. Shorty was the wool classer. He was eating a pie and the crumbs hung from his ginger beard. Brad was already outside his home when we drew up, leant up against his gatepost with his hands in the pockets of his black and white checkered jacket. Brad was a Torres Strait Islander. He had grown a goatee to put age on his young-looking face. He wore a stern expression. Last man in was Lanky Tim. He was bouncing down the street. Tim was 19, spotty, and swore like his dad had only just let him get away with it. Yeah, he was a bit of a dill. Everyone was smoking. I wound a gap in the window to suck in some fresh air. Thick blankets of fog rolled over the paddocks and wrapped around the trunks of the leafless winter trees. The sky behind was peachy orange and getting brighter as we rotated toward the sun. As we drove out to the shearing sheds, we passed the Lake Juniper, a huge salt lake that stretched a couple of miles either side of the road. This huge expanse of sand and salt water looked unnatural out here in the outback, 300 kilometres from the nearest ocean. And it was because the Aussies had followed, or the English at that point, had followed the American style. Two bulldozers with a chain strapped between them to clear the land. But in their haste, they'd left a vast, shadeless place for crops and animals. With no thirsty bush life to keep the water table down, it rose up. This water table has a high salinity. The salt infects the topsoil and everything dies. When the bushes cleared or died, the roots let go of the earth. The loose earth is picked up by the wind and scattered, leaving huge expanses of barren land, aka desertification. That's a big word. We turn sharply off the sealed highway and follow one of the red dirt tracks that carve their way through Western Australia. Tom rarely dropped his speed below 110 k's an hour. On the front of his station wagon, he had a big rhubarb. This served to protect his car should, I quote, "a damn fucking roo bounce out into the road. Roos wreck cars." Tom screamed out, "Fucking parrots!" And a bright green cloud flashed across the front of us. It didn't break. Out the back window, a cloud of feathers and red dust floated to the ground. As their lifeblood pumped out of them into the dirt, we drove a corner and it never happened. The parrots out here, I think they were rosellas. They're named after different types of beer by the shearers, depending on what their colourings were. The red and green ones were VBs, and the blue and red ones were Tuis. They became a familiar sight, scratching for the grain that spilled from the overloaded wheat trucks. They weren't well liked out here in the wheat belt because they ate the crops. Most farmers had the same attitude. Anything that interfered with their profit-making was vermin. All of the tracks and fields looked the same to me, but Tom knew exactly where he was going. A couple of ghost gums marked a gateway and a track that led down to a big tin shed. At the back of the shed in the paddock, the cocky, a.k.a. the farmer, and his kelpie were herding the sheep in a pens. A muscle car skidded down the track behind us. The door swung open and a Jack Russell bounced off the driver's belly and out into the yard. Steve wrestled his gut out from behind the steering wheel, had a stretch, farted and reached into the back for his shearing gear. His Jack Russell had a stretch too, and after a couple of sniffs, the dog glued its nose to a good strong smell on the front of one of Steve's wheels. "Don't piss there, you fucking little!" Steve was a massive bloke, big arms and a belly that seemed to have sucked up most of his arse. His pasty white slabs of feet clawed onto a pair of old thongs. Oil and copious amounts of dirt caked behind the long curling nails. Judging by the sting of his grey on his beard and a cropped thatch, he was in his late 40s. Along with his shearing gear, he was carrying a ghetto blaster slung over his shoulder, a huge bag of cassette tapes. When he saw me, he ambled toward me and offered a hand. He was a massive bear of a bloke. I'm looking up at him, and I'm like, I'm losing the handshake when he picked up on my accent, and he just started to laugh. Oh, you're a pommy. You're going to get some fucking shit out of you, mate. This has got to be some of my most favourite stories to tell. Just because the nutsness of it. And I'm sorry for saying this word, but I just thought, there's no way he's not going to say it. And it's in inverted commas. Ah, you're a fucking pom, pal cunt. You're going to get some shit out of here. Pommy Dung Beetle, C-U-N-T. This was my name from this point forward. Lovely chaps. The working day was broken into 4 2-hour runs. During a run, the shearers go back and forth into the pens, flicking sheep over onto their backsides and dragging them out onto the boards where they are sheared. There were 4 shearers in our gang. Big Steve, Hank, Brad, Shane, and Shorty class the wool, and young Tim. Young Tim and I were roustabouts. Old Tom pressed the wool into bales. As the sheep are sheared, the roustabout has to keep the stand clean, sort the piss stains, blood, and sheep muck out from the wool. The roustabout used a long-handled scraper, which they called a broom, to do this. Dropping this broom is a serious offence. The handle slams hard against the timber boards and the sheep are agitated, making the shearer's job even harder. That's a fucking slab, Shane called out when I first committed the crime. And when the female rouseabouts are there, the rudest shearer's called head job. It's fucking dark ages, these guys. Black wool had to be separated from white because it's impossible to dye black wool, and that can result in the whole wool bale being rejected by the wool market. Oi, Pommy, black wool! Was my signal to isolate the black wool. It was an important task and I had to run on command. Steve would often shout black wool after he'd just dropped his guts and he'd laugh hysterically as I suffered at his feet looking for the imaginary black wool. It's like a frantic pace. You got all these shearers whining, ch-ch-ch-ch, and the sheep being dragged out and the sheep bleating. And then you've got, like, sometimes you've got the cocky's dog chasing the sheep up from the paddock and sheep are just being thrown down the chutes. And it's just like, ch-ch-ch-ch, and they're getting paid per sheep. So it's just fucking nuts. And then Steve's playing some crazy music at high speed to sort of get everybody in the mood. The shears are sharp and the shearers always have a needle and thread ready to stitch up any big cuts made during the chaotic pace of shearing. Often the shears going across loose skin takes a slice off the sheep. The still warm strips of flesh would sometimes stick to the back of my hand when I was sorting through it. It felt even worse when it was cold. Steve told me of some guy last season that cut a sheep so deep in its stomach fell out through the wound. In his stride, the shearer pushed the stomach back in, sewed it up and sent the poor sheep down the chute. It could be cruel in the sheds and some acts were totally unforgivable. A lamb might be swung toward the chute instead of down it, almost cracking its skull on the side. Last season, a blowing shearer sent a sheep out the chute with 2 bloody holes where its eyes used to be. I saw a farmer hold back his puke and bag a sheep's head that was rancid with cancer so he could get 1 last fleece off it before he shot it. I hated to see these things, but who was I to tell them? I was just the Pommy Dung Beetle, C-U-N-T. When the shearers told me to clean up the shit blood and guts, that's what I did. The 2 hour run seemed to last forever. You're just like on a constant jog. One break time, I was sat out the back of the sheds, resting up in the weak winter sun, away from the shearers who had been wearing me down with their constant jibes. Taking comfort in my cup of hot tea, I watched the shorn sheep, stumbling around confused and pathetic looking without their coats. Some sheep were covered in nicks and blood was oozing out. Some had bloody noses. Someone had lost their cool and belted them with a handpiece. The cocky was in the paddock and spraying the newly shorn sheep head to toe with a bright yellow parasite spray. It was hard on the eyes, and out here against a backdrop of gum trees and red earth, it was really trippy. That's the thing, because these sheep were merino sheep, and they had really loose, they had good, they were big sheep with good fleeces, but they have really loose skin. So it's very hard to shear them without cutting the skin. On the next run, I got too close to Shane's handpiece, his shears. A sheep kicked it out of his hand. It came whirling toward me. Fucking hell, Pom, watch it. This'll cut your fucking throat out. I'm sorry, mate, I said, staring into the eyes of this overworked and overhung shearer. I felt in the guts like I was a kid again. But it was early days, I would learn, pull my weight, earn some cash and leave as soon as I could. Fuck 'em. The more shit they gave me, actually, the more I just used my fitness to make up for my lack of skills. I just ran faster. At the end of my first day, I stood under the hot spray of the shower, back at the shearer's quarters, letting the warm water loosen my aching back and wash away the lanolin, blood, piss and sheep shit. As the water splashed around me, I wondered if I could make it out here. Back in clean clothes, I thought I could. Cup of tea in hand and my guitar in the other. I wandered around my lonely little shearer's shack, searching out the best acoustics. Thanks for listening again to my imagination and making your own visuals. I'd just like to thank Dickie Hanlon too, because he's left me a voice message, which is the first voice message I've got so far. So if anyone else feels like leaving me a voice message, there's you can do it on Spotify. I'm not sure about the others, but yeah, have a crack. I don't care what it sounds like. Just leave me a message. I'll appreciate it. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
I just wanted to drop a little message in for an old friend of mine, Richard Morris, and comment on his series of podcasts he's got out now on Spotify, one of many platforms. And it's not just the fact that we go back to a time probably before the dinosaurs were around. But no, in all seriousness, I'm proud to have travelled myself with Rich. And that's a whole different story to the ones that he's released now. I'm very, very proud to call him my friend. And for all you listeners out there, good on you.
Thanks again, Dickie, for leaving that message. Good on you, man. Appreciate it, dude. Can't wait till I do our podcast about Spain. That's going to be nuts. Two 19-year-olds. Caution to the wind. Half a brain between us. It's going to be wicked.